Welcome to Down Among the Donkeys, a podcast from the Donkey Sanctuary. In 13 episodes, we are telling the story behind the founding of one of the biggest equine charities in the world. Down Among the Donkeys by Dr. Elizabeth Svensson. Chapter 3. Early Donkey Days. In January 1973, Bob Forbes, a well-known interviewer on BBC Spotlight, rang to say he would like to come down and do an interview with me and the donkeys. They would arrive in 1.5 hours. Feeling a bit shattered, we bustled around, and true enough, a minibus arrived laden to the roof with men and cameras. "Right, we want a good hee-haw noise to start with," said Bob Forbes. And the soundman, the cameraman, and all the other men stood in silence outside the stable block, waiting hopefully. Of course, donkeys can be stubborn occasionally, and 1 hour later we were all still waiting. "Right," said Bob. "Get all the donkeys together and I'll do an interview." I explained that some donkeys were rescued mares and never mixed with our pedigree stock who were fit to have foals, or with St. Paddy. He was in the most presentable, easily accessible paddock with his 3 wives and 3 children, so we featured him. The man responsible for sound, Tony Turner, was wearing one of those very long, hairy Afghan coats, a sort of motley brown colour, and he set himself up carefully with his gear, behind Bob Forbes and facing me. Time was spent arranging the set. A large rack of hay was by me, and all the mares and foals gathered around to enjoy the action. A little clapperboard man sprang in front of me, and the show was on. It felt most unreal, as Bob Forbes said in his BBC voice, "Mrs. Svensson, what made you start looking after donkeys?" I tried to concentrate and answer clearly, but behind Bob and the camera I could see St. Paddy. He was pawing the ground and snorting. I could hear the camera running, and a microphone and boom was dangling on a long pole 1 foot above my head. "But why donkeys?" insisted Bob Forbes. I was just explaining what gentle creatures they were when my eyes became riveted onto St. Paddy. My voice faded as he started his charge. He had decided the soundman was a new mare, and obviously he had a duty to perform. There was a muffled shriek behind Bob, and the sound man collapsed. The film was finished by late afternoon, and I sank into a chair exhausted, but within 30 minutes the telephone had rung again. "This is Westwood TV. Angela Rippon would like to come and do a film of you and your donkeys." "Oh no," I replied. "The BBC have been here all day. You're too late." "We shall film in colour," they said. "How about 9 in the morning? But their film men wore more conventional coats, so there were no problems. The 2 films came out very well. The donkeys were marvellous, and the hee-haw which heralded both performances was achieved in the end. To get a good sound effect, I just did my early morning call of donkeys as I came to the stables, rattling the feed buckets. It never failed. By this time, the hotel's gardener, Herb Fry, had given up any pretense of doing the hotel's garden. With the stud donkeys and the rescued donkeys, we had reached the amazing figure of 38, and they took some looking after. Fit donkeys need great care to remain in peak condition, but sickly malnourished donkeys need constant daily individual attention. Cleaning out, feeding, grooming, veterinary work, plus trying to help Niels build up the hotel, was becoming almost impossible. People, wanting to help, started to send donations, and every donor needed a personal reply, as the money was so desperately needed, and I really was so grateful. A large donation from friends nearby really made an impact on our finances. Herb and I worked marvellously together. A true Devonshire man, he had a good knowledge of farming and animals, and his gentleness and feeling for the sick animals was apparent. He was much stronger physically than I was, and in 1971 he became a full-time donkey person. At one meeting of the Donkey Breeding Society Council, the name of Violet Philpin came up. She ran the donkey sanctuary, whose full name was, in fact, the Helping Hand Animal Welfare League Donkey Sanctuary, near Reading, and was the subject of a fair amount of concern amongst council members. She was very elderly and was looking after 200 to 250 donkeys, which she had bought in from dealers all over the country. Niels and I decided to visit her. A more dedicated and devoted person we could never meet. She loved every one of her donkeys, but what of their fate if anything happened to her? She must have been 81 on our first visit, and she was in deep financial difficulties. She had trouble with the dealers from whom she bought her donkeys, and we promised to help in any way we could. Only an hour after we got home that evening, she phoned to ask if we could take 6 very bad donkeys that had just been delivered from Reading Market. She felt she just couldn't cope because they were in such a state, and she would send the wagon straight on to us, plus £50 to help cover our costs. By 3 a.m. it arrived. On board were the donkeys we named Biddy, Black Beauty, Bill and Ben, So Shy and Tiny Titch. Their condition was indescribable. Niels and my eldest children, Lisa and Paul, helped them into the biggest stable, which I had emptied in readiness, and we all stood quietly in the early morning light in shocked silence. None of the donkeys could move alone, and their spirits seemed completely broken. The driver was sitting where we left him in the kitchen with a cup of coffee. I said, "Poor little donkeys, they're in terrible condition." "No," he replied, "Reading Market isn't as bad as Southall. You should see 'em there. They'll be all right in a week or so. You'll see." I suddenly wanted to be rid of him. "It's disgusting," I said quietly. "You should be ashamed to even transport them." He stood up in a menacing fashion. "Here, I'm just the driver, and they're just bloody donkeys. Get off my back." And he left the kitchen without drinking his coffee. Niels and the children were still talking quietly to the donkeys, and fed each a little bran mash. We only dared let them have a morsel, as too much can cause severe colic, and in any event it was all they could manage. The slight interest shown on being given a warm meal was enough reward for all of us for the night, so we turned out the light and a very subdued and sad family got to sleep around 4 a.m. There was the usual early morning dash to get breakfast and get the children off to school, and it was 8 o'clock before I was ready to go out to see the early morning delivery. Herb was waiting for me at the back door, his kindly face wrinkled up with concern. From being a young boy, he had always worked on farms and been with animals. To him, farm animals had a simple purpose in life. They were bred carefully, reared properly, and when their time came, culled for human consumption. This was the way of the farmer, and Herb fully approved. In the light of the morning we stood looking at the donkeys. "'Tint right," he said. "Look at that poor little beggar's back." The smallest donkey was shivering in the corner. His back was bent from cowering at the frequent beatings that had been his lot. And the hair looked solid and peculiar. The solid lumps on Tiny Titch were pieces of sacking embedded in his back, with small, broken pieces of spine showing through. He was only about 8 months old. I cried, and so did Herb. Could Tiny Titch stand the anaesthetic the vet would need to give him to remove the sacking? And could we mend his splintered spine? With the vet, we decided to let him recover a little first, and put him in one of the smaller stables with the poor little thin terrified mare, So Shy. With the vet and Herb's help, I was able to touch So Shy gently and look at her teeth to find her age. All her front teeth were broken, congealed blood still on the gums, and she had been beaten as badly as Tiny Titch. The vet gave her an anaesthetic straight away, as she could not possibly eat with her mouth in that condition, and we removed 5 chipped and broken teeth and sewed up her lacerated gums. The only good thing was that they were her milk teeth, and with luck, new ones should replace them. We covered her with a rug and fondled her as she came round. Poor Soshai, what a start! The 2 stallions were both huddled together, and we named them Bill and Ben. They would have to be gelded when strong enough. The other 2 mares consisted of a tiny middle-aged brown one we named Biddy, and a jet-black mare we named Black Beauty. There is a happy ending to this story. Soshai and Tiny Titch recovered fully with us and fell quietly in love. When they were better, I found them a wonderful home in Devon and arranged with the new owners that Tiny Titch should be gelded when he was really strong, the sanctuary paying. They did this when he was 2, but just a little too late. Soshai produced a beautiful little foal 1 year after, and she is embarrassingly friendly now. As we were now a registered charity, proper books had to be kept, and each evening would find me making careful records of the donations received and the expenses involved. We put a collecting box on the reception desk at the hotel, and guests were extremely kind. It was amazing how much money this would collect over a week's period. I wrote our first leaflet, having commandeered one of the old typewriters from the hotel, and had it ronioed off. All the children helped in the evening by putting letters in envelopes and putting stamps on. Everyone who had sent a donation received a leaflet. The donations trickled in, with the average cost per donkey at £2.50 a week and the ever-increasing number of donkeys. Our capital had nearly filtered away. We had wanted a skiing holiday with the children, but just didn't have the funds available. Quite a large number of visitors came to the sanctuary, and many offered to take the donkeys and keep them in their own homes. It would be a good idea, we thought, provided the homes selected were ideal. The first essential was that the donkeys were genuinely wanted for their own sake, and not as riding donkeys on the cheap for their children. We worked out a legal arrangement whereby a selected home, which was willing to take preferably 2 donkeys, gave a donation of between £5 and £20 to us and agreed to keep the donkeys in good condition on a permanent basis. I would always visit the home before the donkeys went out, and thereafter every 6 months to ensure that they were looking after the donkeys properly. If for any reason the owners could not keep the donkeys, they were to be returned, as they were the sanctuary's property at all times, and they could never be sold by their temporary owners. This scheme helped tremendously to keep our numbers down to a reasonable level, and with the fitter ones being transferred to Farway and the sick ones remaining with us, we managed. That April, we were phoned by the RSPCA. A very elderly blind man in a small village on the edge of Dartmoor had to go into hospital, and his donkey would be left alone. Would we take it in? Niels and I set off in our Land Rover and trailer and found ourselves eventually in a dirty farmyard, seemingly totally deserted. We blew the horn, checked it was the right address, and then sat rigid as a donkey slowly waddled towards us. It was enormous. It was so fat, particularly after our usual starved customers. We just could not believe our eyes. "Jenny," came a voice from the house. "Jenny, come here." She waddled slowly past us, up to the back door of the house. An old blind man was struggling to tip a sack of cow cake into the tub by the door. "Let me help," said Niels. "Oh, are you here for Jenny?" he said, and a tear trickled slowly down his old, sightless face. "Yes," said Niels. "We'll take the greatest care of her." "I've no one, you see. It's the end for me. I've lived here nearly 80 years. Old Jenny's kept me company since my wife died 30 years ago." He turned and went into the house. Niels and I looked at each other. "Let's load her up quick," Niels said. It's only going to hurt him if we hang about. What a job! Talk about two-ton Tessie. She only just fitted into the trailer and she didn't want to go in. You'll feed her properly now, won't you? Said the old man. He was standing by the door. For the last 10 years since I lost my sight, I've just kept her bin full of cow cake and she's helped herself. I held his hand and said, Don't worry, I promise we will look after her all her life. I couldn't bear to see him standing there, the tears running uncontrollably down his face, and ran back to the Land Rover. Niels, Jenny and I went slowly home. We called her Fat Jenny, as we already had a Jenny, and a slimmer, more energetic version of herself is still happily with us. Then came Amanda, the result of another desperate call from Miss Philpin, which produced a late-night lorry of donkeys. This one was a miniature donkey, with a very kind nature. She was so gentle, she would nuzzle and cuddle up every time we went into the stable. We put her on a maximum feed as soon as we were able, as it was obvious she was heavily in foal. She had a terrible time when the foal was due, but eventually the vet and I knelt on the straw, desperately trying to get the little colt to breathe. We succeeded, but he was so tiny and his back legs did not seem just right. We named him Peanuts. Amanda was a wonderful mother, and for 4 weeks she cared and loved him, and then disaster. I did my normal round just before going to bed, and on opening Amanda's door, found her lying dead. I desperately listened for sounds through my stethoscope and massaged her heart, but to no avail. Peanuts was an orphan at 4 weeks old. We carried him into the kitchen, and he slept by our aga that night. We had to mix a milk solution with the right amount of water, calcium hydroxide and glucose to suit him. His legs were poor due to bone malformation, but he was such a happy little chap. We made plaster casts for his little legs and changed them every week. But then he began to slip backwards on us. His weight dropped and he became apathetic. At this time we had another foal in trouble, a mare, suddenly rejected her colt named Pancho. For his own safety, we moved him away from her and in with Peanuts. Then a marvellous thing happened. Angelina with St. Dougal, one of St. Paddy's legitimate offspring, was grazing next to the nursery box and showed great interest in the foals. With my heart in my mouth, I let her into the box with Peanuts and Pancho, and she went straight up to them and nuzzled them both, and within seconds both were suckling. That was a turning point for Peanuts. Plaster casts no longer worried him, and every morning he would leave Angelina and come with me to the kitchen, lie quietly on the table whilst his casts were taken off and his leg was dressed, and then go happily back to Angelina, who brought up the three foals until they were all 8 months old. Poor Amanda! Part of the post-mortem report read, The fatty degeneration of the liver was, in my opinion, probably due to the fact that this donkey had been previously undernourished and had maintained herself and her foal, which she produced alive a month previously, at the expense of her body fat reserves. One of our big problems has always been the long gestation period of the donkey, from 11 to 13 months. This means that despite having changed a starving mare into a reasonably fit animal, the damage has been done to the vital organs, and the production of a foal during the difficult early months means we cannot always win. What with the family and our large tribe of donkeys, there was little time for housework, which has never been my biggest love, and I always manage to get somebody to help me with that. Cooking I really do enjoy. We are a great games family, and every night would find us playing Monopoly, Totopoly, or Mahjong. My parents had moved to Ottery St. Mary from the north in 1973 and enjoyed evenings with us. Our favourite annual holiday was to go back to the Norfolk Broads, and each year my parents would take one motorboat, and Niels and I, with our children, would take either one or two yachts, and we would spend a delightful, carefree week sailing the northern rivers which we loved. Herb was able to look after the sanctuary during my absence, and the vets used to visit daily so that we could get away. I absolutely loved the sailing, and Niels and I agreed that we would take a navigation course together in our spare time, and that I would take my radio operator's license, which I felt might be of some use in the future. Taking a navigation course from home was quite fun and a terrific change from my normal day's work. We both got through our course and did an examination taken on the boat to get our radio operator's licenses. It was extremely convenient living within 100 yards of one's business, and every Sunday evening found me at the Salston both winter and summer. Early on, with Keith and Mo, Sunday had been the slackest night of the week. We decided on a candlelit night and some music to interest people and advertised the Salston's candlelit bar. The four of us sat waiting for the anticipated crowds. By 9:30, there wasn't one person there, and we were all getting desperate. At that moment, a car drew in and 4 people appeared in the doorway. "What's on, then?" said a voice from the north. "A power cut," and he leered round the bar, which was dimly lit by candles. "No," said Niels, and explained. The man gazed into the gloom, looking at the empty chairs and tables. "'Tisn't working, is it?" he said. "I'll have a pint of beer," and he slurped over with his pint and sat down with his family at one of the empty tables. I don't know why, but it seemed to put us all on our mettle, and we decided that we would concentrate on trying to get Sunday nights going. We had seen advertised a group calling themselves the Accordionaires, and we asked them to come over for an interview. Cliff and Margaret duly arrived the following Sunday and gave an extremely lively performance using their accordions. Just for a joke, I borrowed their microphone and sang a little song. "Wonderful," they said. "Why don't we try this on a Sunday and see if this gets the crowds in?" And so Salston's sing-along night started. We even got Neil singing "If I Was Born Under a Wandering Star," which became a firm favourite with all the regulars. And that Christmas was quite fantastic, with over 250 people attending, the Ottery St. Mary handbell ringers and school choirs coming to make it an evening to remember. Although it was always very tiring, it was a great change, and Niels and I always enjoyed ourselves. Just after we returned from the Norfolk Broads in May 1973, Maud arrived. Of all the comedians ever to walk into the sanctuary, Maud was the best. She almost equalled Houdini for escapology, despite her 35 years, but never went anywhere. "Hee-ho, hee-ho," right under our window, between 2 and 4 any morning, meant she had done it again, and there she would stand, waiting patiently for us to come down and put her back into her stable, so that she could repeat the episode. She had arrived with a bad attack of pneumonia, and to keep her exercised, I used to put a halter on her, and we would amble up the drive to the hotel and round the track which was known as Salston Ride. She would enjoy eating the tasty thistles that thrived there. It became a habit when she was better for our neighbour's children to take Maud for a walk, and this she adored. Dr. Jeremy Bradshaw Smith lived at the far end of Salston Ride, and his daughter Lucy and our Sarah frequently took Maud on her walks. One hot summer day, the phone rang. It was the doctor. "Your donkey is in my garden," he started. I looked in the lounge, and there were Sarah and Lucy playing, but they must have forgotten Maud. Oh, dear. Desperately, I searched for excuses, apologies. "Can she stay, please?" the doctor was saying. "She's doing a marvellous job. She's going steadily round the edge of the lawn, eating off the pieces the mower won't get to." After that, Maud was frequently in demand as the local lawn mower. On one occasion, she was mowing the hotel's putting green, working efficiently round the edges. 2 rather elderly ladies were playing a serious game of putting, and Niels, talking to the head waiter in the dining room, noticed her ambling across to see what was going on. Intent on their game, her arrival went unnoticed until she decided one of the players needed a little assistance, and what obviously seemed a gentle friendly nudge to Maud was enough, administered in the right place at the right time, to put the guest completely off her stroke. Fortunately, they took it in good part, and Maud was allowed to join in officially after that. She never really disgraced herself, however, and would always wander quietly back home when her job for the day was done. But we needed money, and so put an advertisement in the Sunday Telegraph which read, "Help a little donkey in distress. Recently started donkey sanctuary in desperate need of funds to help with the rescue and rehabilitation of not only the old and sick, but unfortunately also the young and ill-treated donkey. Donations please to the South Western Donkey Sanctuary, Ottery St. Mary, Devon." The response to this was quite amazing, and I had a terrible job trying to reply to the many inquiries and letters, particularly as at that time Jem arrived. Miss Philpin telephoned from Reading, and even for her she was unusually quiet. "I've got such a dreadful case in. I don't really think I can cope. Can you take in an old donkey covered with sores and with her feet cut to ribbons? She has been working on a used car dump in Middlesex and has had a chain harness on and been driven up piles of wrecked cars and then had to pull bits the gypsies wanted all the way down again. The RSPCA rescued her and have sent her to me. I just feel I can't cope, and rather than unload her from this wagon, I'll send her straight on. Please, will you take her? You are my only hope." Herb and I prepared a stable. "You think you are ready for anything, but when that wagon came and the back was opened and we saw that donkey lying there, her feet bleeding, running sores on her chest and quarters where the chains had cut, and her desperate frightened eyes, I was close to tears. We had to carry her, she could not walk, and we laid her on the deep bed of straw and covered her with a woolen rug so that she could rest after the journey. The wagon driver passed me an envelope, and I was overjoyed to find £100 in £1 notes in it, sent by Miss Philpin to help us. Although she was in dire financial straits herself, she recognised our terrible financial problems and was so grateful to us for taking her worst cases, as she must have realised her strength was failing and she couldn't carry on much longer. We named her Jem, and despite her previous treatment, she had the gentlest, kindest nature. She lay down for 3 weeks. We turned her regularly to prevent her getting bed sores, and her feet were bathed and bandaged twice a day. Her chest and rump wounds were bad, and we found an ointment called Dermobian that worked wonders, and she had injections of antibiotics to prevent further infection. Our joy when she felt able to stand made up for the long days we had spent with her. She tottered round her stable and could reach the hay for herself. I got 4 large plastic ice cream containers and twice a day half-filled them with a saline solution in warm water and Savion. Once she got the idea that one was for each foot, she showed the most amazing intelligence. Gently she would step into each and stand for hours, a blissful expression on her face, gently chewing hay from the net we hung within reach. Visitors found it hilariously funny, but we never laughed at her, though we sometimes had to laugh with her as she began to find life worth living again. The first day we were able to let her go into the grassy paddock was memorable. Her obvious delight and the fact that after a brief look round, a sample of the grass and a brief rub against a nearby tree, she returned to the gate and gave me a quick nuzzle before doing her lovely victory roll in the sand patch we always provided, showed her gratitude and her way of giving thanks. She lived for a glorious 4 years before dying a natural, peaceful death with us around her. I now began to make regular visits up to Farway to supervise the fencing of the area loaned to us by Mrs. Forbes. We needed shelters as well before we could put the donkeys there, as it was very open, exposed land and apart from individual stables, an area where we could store food and hay necessary for feeding the donkeys. I got a local firm of contractors from Ottery St Mary, who had built the stables at Salston Close, to erect the stables at Farway, and I was extremely grateful when they were all completed, and we were able to take our first donkeys up to graze in the Farway Countryside Park. It was wonderful having Mrs. Forbes and Morris look after them for us, and every evening I would slip up with the children to make sure that everything was going well. We managed to pay for the shelters from the money coming in regularly now, from the Telegraph advertisements. One or two really large donations came in at this period, which were very welcome, but we were beginning to realise that we needed much more room if we were to continue. We saw in the paper that a farm was for sale at Teignmouth, and Niels and I drove out to see if it was any use to us. It would have been ideal. The long sheds which had been used for caged minks were just high enough to house donkeys, and we reckoned that we could winter almost 100 donkeys there if we had to. However, something had to be done rather desperately, and we asked how much the owner wanted for his farm. We were absolutely horrified to find it was almost £1,000 an acre. There was no way we could arrange this sort of finance, and we were both very depressed to be told that this was the sort of price we would have to pay to buy agricultural land in our district. On approaching various land agents, we found this was only too true. Miss Philpin had made a habit of ringing me late in the evening to ask if I could take donkeys that had got into trouble. Poor Miss Philpin, she was obviously deeply concerned over her inability due to failing health to take in more animals in need, and it can't have helped her when I poured out my troubles and problems and inability to find sufficient finance I needed to buy a large enough property to cope with the incoming number of donkeys. She was very sympathetic one night on the phone and said, "Never mind, dear, I'm sure it will turn out all right, and you never know, I may be able to help," at the same time asking me to take 6 small donkeys. The donkey rehabilitation scheme was working, although not without its difficulties. Not all prospective owners agreed with my conditions to take the donkeys. Most had no qualms in filling in the questionnaire I had designed and giving a donation, but one irate lady took it very badly. "How dare you ask for money when I'm prepared to give one of your donkeys a good home? You should be extremely grateful that I'm willing to help. And why should I take 2? I have only 1 daughter, so who is going to ride the other one? Tell me that." Another difficult interview was with a husband and wife who turned up and offered to take a couple of donkeys. But they had to be a matching pair of greys between 9 and 10 hands, be biddable at all times, and strong enough to give daily rides to their 2 sons, aged 8 and 10. I escaped inside, mumbling about finding forms, and when I had gained control of my temper, found them in the stables with Naughty Face, Angelina, and St. Paddy. "We'll have these 2, even though the colours are wrong," they said. "Can you arrange for a cattle lorry to bring them down?" No way were they going to take Naughty Face and Angelina, but I gave them the forms and questionnaire. "My God," said the husband, "it is easier to adopt a baby than a donkey." Whereupon he tore the form into tiny pieces and they left in grim silence, and to add insult to injury, they backed their large Jaguar car over our front lawn. Many good offers of homes did come in, and it was difficult at times to go and inspect them. My sister Pat, who lived in Bristol, offered to help when a good home was offered in her area. An elderly lady rang one night to say that she and her 2 spinster sisters were prepared to give a home to 3 donkeys, and assured me that they would be well looked after for the rest of their lives. Pat took the address and rang me the next evening. She was ecstatic. "Bet," she said, "it's unbelievable. It's an enormous house. It stands in beautiful grounds with fenced paddocks, walled gardens, and a complete stable block built for 10 racehorses, and the original grooms who keep them spotless. despite the fact that there have been no horses there since their father died 15 years ago. From the stable boy up, and he's in his mid-70s, they would all love the donkeys, and there's nothing they wouldn't have. We couldn't get a better home for them. Bill and Ben, who had now been gelded, had made friends with another gelding named Boots, and these we selected for the three elderly ladies. They were duly delivered and received with all the love and attention they could wish for. I telephoned in midsummer to find all was absolutely marvellous. Each sister had her own favourite, and the donkeys were good as gold. It was a great relief to know they were settled, and I was surprised to receive a desperate telephone call in December. "Mrs. Svensson, I'm sorry, but you will have to take Bill and Ben back. They've got to be such naughty boys. Boots can stay. He's such a good little boy," the voice continued. "But we just cannot cope any longer with the other two." "I am so sorry," I said. "Whatever are they up to?" "They have got so disobedient. Boots goes straight up the stairs when we tell him, but no matter how we push and pull, Bill and Ben refuse to go up. You know, we are elderly ladies, Mrs. Svensson. We can't be expected to do such heavy work." I paused. "Did you say up the stairs?" I asked. "But of course. You don't think that we can lie upstairs in our warm beds at night and leave those three little pets in their stables, do you?" the slightly irate voice answered. "It gets cold, you know. They use the guest bedroom." And so regretfully back came Bill and Ben, followed 1 month later by Boots, who ceased to be angelic when his little friends departed. The 20th of June was Neil's birthday. This was 1974, and we came back from an enjoyable celebration at 11:15 in the evening. Clive's head popped round the bedroom door. "That you, Mum? There's a very important message. Whatever time you get in tonight, you've got to ring this number, and it's very urgent." He gave me a Reading telephone number, and still in a slightly merry state, I wandered down to my little office. Neil's behind me. I rang the number, and a voice answered. "Mrs. Svensson? Mrs. Elizabeth Doreen Svensson?" "Yes," I replied. "This is Mr. Holman from the Barclay Trust. Are you sitting down, Mrs. Svensson?" I sat down, feeling suddenly very sober. "Mrs. Svensson, you have been left a legacy." Visions of thousands of pounds floated across my mind. I'd never had a legacy before. "How wonderful," I said. "How much?" "Mrs. Svensson," said the voice, "it's 204 donkeys." Ha ha ha!